It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're looking at the history of the United States in order to possibly divine its future. The book that got us thinking about this is American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. The book shows, with detailed descriptions and maps, how the U.S. is really 11 nations that don't neatly fit into the state lines we've drawn. It's written by Colin Woodard, a state and national affairs writer at the Portland Press Herald in Maine, and a 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist. His most recent book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good, examines the very struggle at the heart of our nation's angst today. Colin, welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm pleasure to be here. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. I should note that Colin is joining us by Skype. So you've redrawn this map of the United States to pull together what you call regional cultures. What do you mean by that? And what made you think of this?
Well, the backstory is that in college I was a Soviet and East European history major at the end of the Cold War and spent my junior year abroad in Hungary and throughout Eastern Europe as communism collapsed. And I stayed on, became a foreign correspondent, started my journalism career there knowing the history. And that's a place where the deep historical fissures do not match the official lines on the map with great mischief and terrible result. And everybody there knows their history and realizes this for better or worse. So when I came back to North America and was traveling around and becoming more acquainted with with our broader geography and seeing these things, I started realizing that the differences between our regional cultures were even greater than the ones you would see in Europe. And that's what eventually led 15 years later to working on American Nations.
Okay. Go ahead. So,
and the central idea of that is that there's never been one America. There have always been several Americas because the separate colonial projects that happened along the East Coast and the southwestern rim of what's now the United States, each one was set up entirely independently, not expecting to be part of the same continent-spanning federation, and set up by people like the New England cluster of colonies, the Chesapeake cluster of colonies, the culture that emerged out of the Charleston beachhead set up by English slave traders from the West Indies, and many others. Each of them had entirely different ethnographic and religious and cultural characteristics. Some of the regional cultures tie back not to the English world at all, but to the Dutch and the French. And each of them evolved their own idea of what the society and then later the America they were creating was. And here's the amazing thing is that they each ended up colonizing and setting forth the initial settlements in nearly exclusive settlement bands as they moved westward across the continent in different settlement tiers. And the implications of this can be felt and seen today in all sorts of ways, from politics to dialect.
Okay, so wait a second. Let me clarify this. So the original settlers who came to various points on the East Coast, they then went west and took their culture with them and settled specific parts of the middle area and the West Coast. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. And that as they moved, they were moving in separate settlement bands, right, and bringing the institutions, the cultural assumptions, the stories about who we are, all the stuff that anthropologists, you know, consider and consider culture to be comprised of were being laid down by each of these separate projects. And they didn't follow state boundaries at all. Mm-hmm. They were just following the tiers and contours of the settlers. And they avoided each other to a great degree, resulting in deep fissures that cut through many states. Not so much my home state of Maine or Wisconsin, but states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Missouri and California and Texas have very clear and radically different regional characteristics that the people in those states are well aware of.
Okay.
And this is why.
So let's talk about Texas, for instance. What is the makeup of Texas today?
Right. So, I mean, all Texans know that Austin is the state capital, but that Houston and San Antonio and Dallas are the hubs of three very different Texases. So if you're down in South Texas, that's a whole region that was successfully and initially colonized from south to north as the the northern frontier of Spain's vast colonial project in the Americas. They were the first Europeans to come and take over the land and set down settlements, and the legacy of that remains in all sorts of ways. The eastern stretch of the state, moving along the Gulf Coast down to about Corpus Christi, was settled via the Deep South by settlers coming along the Gulf Coast, exiting Louisiana, but drawn from the lower Gulf states. And a third prong had come down into sort of North Texas and down into the Texas Hill Country, which was the southernmost extension of a greater Appalachian settlement drive that had occurred over generations, extending all the way up, if you worked backwards, all the way up the Appalachian Mountains, eventually to south central Pennsylvania, driven by Scots-Irish settlers from the war-torn borderlands of Britain with an entirely different cultural makeup and values than the other two that I mentioned.
So what I'm hearing is that from the south we got Spanish settlers, from the east directly, they came from what you're calling New France, right? That Louisiana, New Orleans area. And from the north came the Scotch-Irish. If that is correct, yes, no?
Almost. Those coming in from the east were coming from deep south.
Oh.
So not the Cajun country of New France settled by, it's French-speaking settlers from Acadie, but rather just to the north of there, working along where the actual roads and later railroads actually carried from. So they're coming from the central and northern parts of Louisiana, but especially from Alabama and Mississippi and parts of Georgia is where the main settlement route was coming.
So
I
should note for our listeners that we are talking to Colin Woodard, who wrote a book talking about the 11 different areas of the U.S. that kind of have come together to make up this country. We have a map on WPR.org. You can go in the program notes and see this map, because it's really kind of fascinating to see the areas that we're talking about. We are also taking your calls about what you see the differences are among people in the U.S. How does this clash create problems, and how is it actually good for our country, maybe? 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Okay, Colin, so let's talk about some of the specific characteristics of these 11 nations. Start where you want to start.
Sure. Well, a couple that are show a lot of the contrast are to talk about what I call Yankeedom on one side and, say, Greater Appalachia on the other. And Yankeedom is the culture that started with the Puritan migration into New England in the 1630s. And it's a culture founded by radical Calvinists who thought that they were had a special relationship with God. They were chosen people in covenant with him, and that they were tasked with creating a more perfect and godly society, as they thought of it, right here. And so they were making a city on the hill. They were gathered together in this mission to collectively, through shared institutions, make a more perfect society. And what was really important was not the individual freedom and success, but building of a free and successful community. So the emphasis was always on the community's success over the individuals to a greater degree than other places. And so, it ended up extending the early Puritans annexed the old colony of the Pilgrims on Cape Cod and the Royalist settlements of Sir Ferdinand Gorges in Maine and pulled New Hampshire and Connecticut into their orbit. And then later, when the Dutch were defeated, who controlled what's now New York City in the 1660s, they had made a successful claim, because Massachusetts had claimed all land all the way to the Pacific, over for land title of large parts of upstate New York, which were settled again by New Englanders, by Massachusetts-based land companies, bringing and setting down New England-style villages with their town green and their meeting house and their public school. And the same thing happened in the Strip of Ohio. That's right along Lake Erie. That's the Western Reserve of Connecticut, because Connecticut had a land claim as wide as Connecticut going to the Pacific. So when the Ohio Territory was created, there was a compromise to settle the claim, and Connecticut was given the right to have Connecticut-based land companies settle the Western Reserve of Ohio and only the Western Reserve, which has had completely different political characteristics than parts of Ohio settled by other places. You fast forward the history of the Michigan Territory, same thing. The first pioneers of the lumber trade, the first settlers and government leaders who came in and set out the Constitutional Convention, who were the five of the first six territorial governors dominating the early legislatures that set down the norms of the Michigan Territory, were almost entirely from the Yankee Western Reserve of Connecticut, the Yankee settled upstate of New York, or New England itself. And the same thing happened a generation later in Wisconsin and then in Minnesota. So it's a greater zone that shares and is tied back to a particular tradition there, which is very different than, say, Greater Appalachia.
Okay, so we're going to get to Greater Appalachia in a moment. We are examining the history of the U.S. through the migration patterns of its early inhabitants with author Colin Woodard. We'll look more closely at how that affects us today and some of the other areas that Colin writes about in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking to author Colin Woodard about the disparate history of migration that made the U.S. He has identified 11 different regional cultures that make up North America. How did the points of view from people in, say, Greater Appalachia interact with the points of view from people from Yankeedom? And how do they still interact? How do you think historical sentiment translates to today? Do you see the effects of the past, or are Americans more evolved now? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Colin, we left off. You were talking about Yankeedom and how Yankeedom sort of has put its fingers into various different Western cultures as it moved west. Now talk about Appalachia.
Yeah, so it offers a contrast to everything we just said about Yankeedom. Greater Appalachia was founded in the 18th century, so somewhat later, and it was settled by settlers coming from the war-torn borderlands of Britain, from Northern Ireland, from the lowlands of Scotland, and the English Marches. And these were places where, for generations, life was brutal, nasty, and short. There weren't very many government institutions protecting you. War was a constant problem, and raids. If the government showed up, it was usually a bunch of people on horseback trying to mow down your family with lances. Nothing good was going to come of the king and government. And you had to protect your kith and kin yourself. And so it was this warrior culture with a great emphasis on maintaining personal sovereignty and individual liberty. And it is this culture from which was drawn that came to the frontier of Pennsylvania, into south central Pennsylvania, and formed the core of what became Greater Appalachia's culture. And this migration was enormous. In the 1730s, 40s, and 50s, this was by far the greatest immigration wave that America and British North America had ever seen. And the culture came down the Great Wagon Road, down the Appalachian Mountains, with tributaries breaking off to settle the back country of states like Virginia and North Carolina and South Carolina, but also extending all the way on into the Ozarks of Arkansas, on into the Texas Hill Country, and even parts of Oklahoma. And then a second branch of it came over the mountains into Kentucky, and then settled via rafting all the way down the Ohio Valley to settle the lower tiers of states like Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and parts of Missouri. And this culture, in contrast to the Yankees, you have that absolute emphasis on individual liberty, that freedom is about maximizing the autonomy of individuals, and that organized and efficient government, the actual goal of the Yankee settlement pattern, is in fact a form of tyranny and needs to be resisted at all costs. So institutional fabric was weaker and the emphasis on individual liberty stronger. Now, if you play that out, if you imagine a federation with just those two cultures in it, imagine how fractious it is, because each's definition of freedom itself is contrary. The Yankees would say that freedom is about building a free community that will keep the, rapacious potential aristocrats from forming, that tyranny is when one individual rises up and lords over the community, and therefore you need to protect the community's freedom against that. Whereas in Greater Appalachia, it's the opposite interpretation. It's that government itself is the form of tyranny, because that's also been their experience going way back, and that it's about maximizing individual freedom and keeping government and public institutions at bay. So there's a whole spectrum with the 11 regional cultures of different takes on these things, but it leads to an extremely complicated and fractious federation, which is part of the reason our Constitution was written the way it is and why we experience the political deadlocks and upheavals that we do.
Very interesting. We are taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. Jeff from Marshfield, welcome to the program.
Well, welcome. Thank you. Listening to Mr. Woodard talk, it had occurred to me that when my wife and I were first married and we had moved to other parts of the country, in the United States, the areas have a look to them that probably had to do with the migration of cultures over the years. For instance, when we lived in Nebraska, I would point out to her, I say, see that person over there and that person over there? Yeah, I said, do you see the look that they have? It's probably from Czech. Czech settlements came in that area. When we moved to Missouri and southern Missouri and northern Arkansas, and I said, I don't know what to call it, so I'll call it hillbilly. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I said, do you see the look? And she said, yeah. And when we still refer to that to this day, now that we've moved back to central Wisconsin, we have a look from the Polish and German enclaves that came here, the people who are in this area. And when my son was married, moved to California, he brought his wife back here, and she said, boy, people here are homely. And I said, what? And I said, no, wait a minute. And then it dawned on me, I understood what she meant. She didn't word it maybe as actually as could have been done, but it's a look that certain regions of the country have. And until you move from here and go there and you set your mind up to see what you see, you don't understand what you see. And when you look back at the migrations that happened, then it becomes clear to you, oh, I see what happened. And if you look in the phone book, you begin to understand all the names, and you go, oh, these must have been an area where there's a lot of skis here and a lot of Schneiders, and you go down south and there's a lot of Czech names, and there's different places, you know, and you just don't realize that until you've been there. And when he started talking and began to understand my experience.
Very interesting. Thank you for that, Jeff. I don't think, by the way, that the people here are homely, but there's definitely a difference between, you know, sort of the stout Midwestern body and the long, tall New England body. And, you know, I'm like, people have physical characteristic differences.
I mean, settlement patterns are influenced by culture, and immigration has been influenced by the cultures. So, I mean, what Jeff is describing, you absolutely have settlement clusters and even what one might call reproductive clusters, where groups of people are together and may have, you know, appearance differences. But in the end, the American nation's paradigm, if you will, is not about genetics. It's about culture. Mm. So the notion is that you know, even if the it's built on a guy named Wilbur Zelinsky, a famous cultural anthropologist, theories about how new cultures get started. And he said that the initial settlement culture, when you colonize an area that is able to first create a self-perpetuating society, that the initial settlers and their culture will have an inordinate influence over the future trajectory of that society, even if their numbers were very small compared to the flood of people who followed them, because they set down the sort of, as a fait accompli, the cultural norms that the rest of us encountered and sort of you had to deal with or assimilate into or resist, but the cultural characteristics that were already laid down were laid down by those early settlement groups. So the initial settlers could have, and their descendants, genetically speaking, could have entirely disappeared, but the cultural trace and infrastructure they leave, it remains and remains powerful, which is why New York City, settled by the Dutch, which is like 0.01% Dutch American today, according to the census, is a staggeringly Dutch place and could only be what it is today with its Dutch foundations as a commercial global city-state modeled on Golden Age Amsterdam. But the actual Dutch are gone. Now, does it affect immigration, and therefore could you have differences in appearance, morphological differences between people? Yeah, sure it can, because when the great immigration waves were happening, particularly in the 19th century, the immigrants did not come and randomly arrive in the United States. They came to certain locations. They did their research. Some places, you know, if you go through the census data to see where immigrants went on a county level, essentially in the great sort of, you know, 1870 to 1920 immigration wave, nobody went to the Deep South, Greater Appalachia, or Tidewater, because none of those places offered any of the opportunities that people were looking for, fleeing, you know, lands where there was no, you know, free land, freehold land, and you were living in a feudal environment. They all went to Yankeedom, New Netherland, and another culture called the Midlands, which kind of stretches through the central part of the Midwest. And so the immigration itself and the immigrant experience, the arrival of Germans and Czechs and people from Scandinavia were regionally experienced, increasing the differences between those cultures that had lots of people coming in and those who
Colin?
Secondary factor, but certainly plays into things.
So what I'm interested in, Colin, is we've been talking about, there are 11 different nations that you identify, and we talked about two of them. The Far West and also the Left Coast, which you have as two different things, it seems to me that that's where people have come together more. Most people in California are from somewhere else, or maybe they're a generation removed from somewhere else. Most people in Las Vegas, I can tell you, are from somewhere else. So how does that play out?
Overall, the picture is that when somebody moves either from one regional culture to another or from a foreign country to one of these regional cultures within the U.S., that they, like anywhere else in the world, may, you know, bring their culture and their language with them, celebrate it. They have their kids. Their kids might know both languages and celebrate both and be proud of being an XYZ American. But by the time you get to the grandchildren's generation, you know, they generally have assimilated into the culture they're within, even if they are aware of their own identity. And the central argument of the book is, in the United States, it's not an American culture that you've assimilated into over time. It's one of these regional cultures, right down to the dialect of American English that you speak. Mm. So that's the ultimate force. So, yes, in places where, like Las Vegas, or other places in the Sun Belt, the Orlando region of Central Florida, where you've had a huge migration of people in living memory from other parts of the country. The short-term answer is yes, you have people from all over the place, but the paradigm would hold that over time, in the big picture, in the second and third generation, the culture wins out, you know, the assimilative powers of that do. And I think in our historical experience, that's generally been true. And the difference between what I call the Left Coast, which, for those not looking at the map, if you go to the West Coast, you start around Monterey in California, a little Chile-shaped strip, mm-hmm, going on the coastal side of the coastal mountain ranges, starting from Monterey, California, going through San Francisco, on up through the Pacific Northwest, including the Willamette Valley of Oregon and the Puget Sound region of Washington, and indeed continuing up through British Columbia all the way to Juneau, Alaska. Mm. That coastal strip has an entirely different settlement history early on and cultural pattern than the interior of all those states and provinces. And in short, there was an attempt by the Yankees by sea to colonize those coastal regions because it was easier and faster and safer in the mid-19th century when those were first colonized to come by sea. And they were literally trying to create a New England on the Pacific. And they were going to extend the New England way and experiment to these new regions.
Wait a second. Did you just tell me that there's a reason why liberal community-minded people are both on the East Coast and the West Coast? Because
correct.
Okay.
Yeah, because those cultural institutions were laid down early. Now, it's different from Yankeedom because there was a second spear. The greater Appalachians came as well to that region overland, generally, from the Appalachian-settled parts of the Midwest by wagon, which was the dangerous route. And they ended up settling sort of usually the countryside and smaller towns where the Yankees were concentrated in the ports. And the end result is this amazing hybrid culture that gives you the Left Coast, which has both that sort of utopian Yankee, we can build a better society here on Earth and we're going to do it. It combines that sort of California dream, with a very un-Yankee emphasis on individual self-realization, actualization, and the like. So you get this interesting hybrid culture, and none of that is true in the far West and the interior West, which is much more of a much settled, much more haphazardly, because the conditions in the mid-19th century were so staggering, the remoteness, the hostility environment, the distance from markets, that they could only be settled through the transfer of enormous infrastructure, either built by corporations from far away, the railroad companies, the mining companies, or by the federal government itself building these huge, you know, inter-watershed water transfer projects to make it possible to farm there. So what I'm saying is there, big infrastructure projects like railroads guided and preceded settlement. And so the place was treated as an internal resource colony to be exploited by the other nations. And all the settlers who came from all over the place to that region are deeply aware of it. The resentments towards those things have propelled politics in that region. But it's the one region, the far West, the interior West, where environment did indeed trump ethnography, where the conditions were so staggeringly hostile that it stopped all these other regional cultures in their tracks. So in that sense, the cultures break apart and the environment had this enormous influence in that one very vast region in the center of the country.
The far West has broken free of this. The other regions, are they still struggling with the original immigration patterns? Have any of the other regions evolved and maybe morphed into one another?
The one change on the map, I mean, you know, if you look at the world and how cultures and civilizations and the imprint they leave even after the empire is conquered, I mean, yes, things can disappear, but they have a lot of inertia. It takes a long time. And the one place on the map where you're really seeing change is in the Chesapeake country, right, where the early Virginia and early Maryland came. This was the country where the second and third sons of English, noble families of manorial gentry came to try to rebuild the world of the English countryside in the late 17th century. It was sort of like an early version of Downton Abbey, yeah. Right? You've got these, we're enlightened lords, and we have the interest of the community in mind, but okay. Of course we're the only ones who should rule.
Hang on a second. Let's get to that Chesapeake area, because I'm interested in how these various regions and how various cultures can come together. I think that's the goal of your book. We are talking to Colin Woodard, who wrote a book about the different migration patterns to the U.S. and how they affect our politics and the way we see ourselves today. We're going to look more closely at that in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Author Colin Woodard writes about the disparate history of migration that made the U.S. He has identified 11 different regional cultures that make up North America, and his new book looks at the sweet spot between individual liberty and the common good. Where do you think that sweet spot is? How do Colin's 11 regions fit into your view of the U.S.? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Colin, we were talking about Appalachia, about the Chesapeake area where Maryland is. You were saying that that is a place where we have actually maybe integrated the different areas, the different cultures.
Yeah, you're seeing a transformation, because where I was going with that is that that's the culture that produced, the enlightened gentlemen like Washington and Madison and Jefferson, and was a place with great emphasis on tradition and hierarchy and respect for authority. All that in the past 50 years has completely transformed, and that culture is actually vanishing. Even though it had an enormous effect in the revolutionary period in the early republic, it's disappearing because, first of all, that culture was unable to expand westward because it was hemmed in to the west by Greater Appalachia. But secondly, and perhaps more consequentially, it has been eaten away by the presence of two massive federal halos, so to speak, in the midst of the tidewater. The District of Columbia, the center of the federal government, and the world's largest naval base in Hampton Roads in Southern Virginia, around Norfolk. And those are two places where now millions of people have been able to live because of the presence of the federal government and trillions of dollars now in spending. They can live there without any cultural, social, or economic reference to the tidewater Chesapeake culture around them. And the effect is that that culture's been disappearing and becoming much more like a neighboring region, the Midlands, much more focused on a sort of community, what we would today call middle class level, with a much more of a mosaic of communities of different groups living side by side. That idea of America as a mosaic of cultures that can all live next to each other. So you're seeing a very dramatic change, including in politics and everything else, is that very old culture disappears from the map.
Do you see this as a harbinger in the for the future, that this is what America could look like?
I don't think, I mean, in some ways, yes, but the path forward, because the deep values of these cultures are so ingrained in the, you know, the intent and the goals, and the idea of what each region more or less thinks America should become, it's hard to compromise exactly, but what happens is there are shared interests between regions that give you a shared platform where they can pick these things that they agree on. And that's how, for decades at a time, a particular political philosophy or set of ideas has, you know, won the day and governed the, you know, controlled the federal government for decades. There's times when a Deep South-led coalition was able to do that, and there were times when a Yankee-led coalition was able to do that. In recent decades, we don't have that. That's why our politics is so fractious. But it is, in fact, possible if a political formation or a party or whatnot comes forward with a platform that delivers you a sort of supermajority of the regions, you can create a coalition that can really, you know, control the levers of federal power, right? You need a filibuster-proof Senate majority, right, the House of Representatives, and the presidency, because we have all these checks. Okay. We have all these checks in our system because the regional cultures didn't trust each other, right?
Right. So that brings up lots more questions. We also have a caller, Mark from Eau Claire. Welcome to the program.
I can't remember your name for the area from Monterey up to British Columbia.
Left Coast. Left Coast, I call it.
The Left Coast. Well, I've just returned from a year there, and I lived there back in the 70s. And it was the most phenomenal area because it was quite rugged, but there were just phenomenal resources. The best fisheries in the world, fabulous wineries, just huge trees, the redwoods. In order to survive there, the people who were there had developed just a phenomenal level of technological skill and a really great work ethic. And the resources were mismanaged and pretty much sold off to businessmen like Ivan Boesky in return for, I guess, political favors or bribes.
So, Mark, thank you very much for that. We've got limited time here. I appreciate you calling. I'm interested in the technological savvy that he saw even before Silicon Valley came to be. So maybe Silicon Valley couldn't have happened anywhere else, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, that's the incredible thing. Think about it. The Left Coast is a country. There's like, I don't know, 23 million people there. It's like smaller than Poland. And think about all of the companies that are transforming and in some ways sort of controlling life in the 21st century across the globe. They're all based in the Left Coast in this one tiny part of the entire world. You have, you know, Silicon Valley, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, Google. I mean, it's all there in this one strip. And that's no accident. It's because that combination, that strange Appalachia-Yankee hybrid of we can, you know, build a better society, but we're going to really pay attention to individuals like, you know, dreams and self-actualization. That's turned out to be a really fecund environment for entrepreneurialism that's created all of these technologies and all of these things for good or bad in that one part of the world. So, okay. Yeah, there's something to that for sure.
Okay, so your 11 Nations book came out in 2012. I'd like you to tell me how this played out in the 2016 election.
Yeah, so the big conflict, and I talk about this a bunch in American Character, that between these regional cultures and at the center of the American conversation is about freedom. What, you know, how do you make a free republic really free? And there's a look that you do it the greater Appalachian way, that it's about individual freedom, that if there's less government and less taxes and less regulation, that axiomatically individuals would be more free. And the counter argument is more of that Yankee argument that is, no, you have to build a free community to keep rapacious individuals away, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Colin, you there?
Because of that conflict, you end up having basically one party will be more individualistic in its arguments and the other party will be more on the communitarian kind of side. What Trump did was really unusual in 2016 and allowed him to capture the Electoral College. And that was this. He was the most, you know, there were 16 other candidates for the Republican Party presidential nomination in 2016. All the other ones said, you know, less government, less regulation, more freedom, that approach. Donald Trump did not. He was the only one who didn't. He made a whole bunch of very communitarian promises. We were going to rebuild America's infrastructure. We were going to replace the Affordable Care Act with something cheaper with better coverage. We were going to use somehow the federal government was going to be able to step in and use the levers of the state in order to rebuild American industry. That he was going to break with a laissez-faire consensus on international immigration and trade. And that allowed him to make, he didn't, you know, if you look at the American nation's map, Trump didn't do any better particularly on the map than mm-hmm. Mitt Romney or John McCain had before him. He got similar shares of the vote in most of these nations, if you break it out, with a couple notable exceptions. And that was rural voters, rural counties in Yankeedom in the Midlands, which are both rather communitarian, more community freedom, common good ethos places. And in those rural counties, you had an enormous flip of scores of counties that had voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 that flipped and voted strongly for Trump, I think based on these communitarian promises. And in fact, you're seeing, as most of those promises are not being delivered on, polling is showing that many of those places are flipping back. But overlay the Electoral College map, and those ended up being crucial to being able to eke out a victory to get the Electoral College votes of Wisconsin and Michigan, and also in Pennsylvania and Ohio, where a Democratic candidate has to do very well in the Yankee and Midland sections of those states to counteract staggering losses cycle after cycle in the greater Appalachian parts. So that, in short, is how Donald Trump was able to win his victory, because he was not a Republican candidate like others, and that had a marginal gains in key areas that helped him on the map.
He straddled very different communities. I'd like to talk in the few minutes we have left about how slavery has played into this. I mean, there's a whole now, there are generations of people whose ancestors came over here as slaves. How does that play into these various nation states?
Yeah, well, as a preamble, I mean, race and racism are a, you know, critical problem in all of these regional cultures. It's experienced differently in each one, but you could write a whole book about each one. Mm-hmm. But the key, when you talk about slavery precisely, so the big difference is that in Tidewater and Deep South, these are societies that ended up being built around slavery, that ended up being the central fixture of the society and the economy around which everything else was built, and ultimately the Confederacy broke off from the United States to protect. So that's to have that be the center of your system is very different than having a society that has slaves in it, which would have been true of early, you know, New England, was true of the New Netherland Dutch territory as well. And that has deep implications for our history, because you ended up in those in the Deep South and Tidewater, you had first a race-based slave system, but then for generations thereafter, you had a apartheid system based on race with people separated, and that was enforced by both law and vigilante justice. So that's a terrible and powerful legacy.
Right. So what does it tell us about the makeup of those states now?
You mean politically speaking demographically?
Politically speaking. I mean, because I'm looking at the map and I see Greater Appalachia and Deep South. And yes, they were colonized by white Europeans from different places. But then those white Europeans brought in Africans to be their slaves? And how has that changed those areas?
Well, that they, I mean, in the Deep South, they did that from the first moment, right? The Deep South was founded at Charleston by English slave lords from Barbados and the British West Indies, who were bringing a fully formed, you know, horror show slave sugar plantation society. They'd run out of space on their tiny islands by the 1670s, and they needed somewhere for the new generation, for their second and third sons, to go set up plantations. And the new colony of Carolina, in fact, they called it Carolina in the West Indies, had opened up, and they came there, and they brought a completely formed Caribbean slave system to that region. That very different environment than the Tidewater, right, which had these lords who were trying to create a manor system.
Okay, I've got to stop you there, Colin. There is so much more to talk about. We've been talking about the amalgam of regions that make up the U.S. and how that affects us still with Colin Woodard. He's a state and national affairs writer at Portland Press Herald and a 2016 Pulitzer finalist. His book, Nations, identifies 11 regional cultures that make up the U.S. Thanks for being with us today, Colin.
Thank you very much.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Healy Boltina is the executive producer, and I'm Carrie Kaufman.